This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
They're changing a range of different policies to make sure the wealth that comes from under the soil and from the human material of the country is being more broadly distributed amongst the people of these various Sahelian countries in the Alliance for Sahel States.
The Alliance of Sahel States continues on its path to sovereignty and social justice.
It's not supported by the labor movement, and what we're finding out is that it's almost all coming from the U.S. government, and now that Trump's cut it off, this whole project, which they're so very proud of, and like I said, it's gone on for over 120 years, is about to be shut down.
Trump cut funding for the National Endowment for Democracy, but AFL-CIO's Solidarity Center is pleading for its reinstatement in a new court filing.
This is a march that says hands off. And we're saying hands off Palestine.
Code Pink speaks out against messaging at the nationwide hands off rallies, which included hands off NATO and excluded hands off Palestine.
We're low hanging fruit because we're federal workers and he has control of the federal workforce. So he's going to start with us and then he'll come for you.
Activists are calling the federal government's rejection of the TSA and AFGE workers' contract a PATCO 2 moment in union busting. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Between 2021 and 2023, West Africa saw three popular military coups. Assimi Goïta became the president of Mali in 2021. Ibrahim Traoré became the president of Burkina Faso in 2022. And Abdourahmane Tchiani became the president of Niger in 2023. The three former French colonies expelled French and U.S. military. They withdrew from the Western-dominated ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, and confederated, forming the Alliance of Sahel States. They announced their intention to cooperate on regional security, integration, sovereignty, and economic independence. In January, they announced a common passport, and in February, they raised a common flag. In March, Togo signaled its intent to leave ECOWAS and join the landlocked alliance, giving it access to the sea. There's talk of Senegal and other bordering states following suit. I spoke to Eugene Puryear, author, journalist, and Breakthrough News host, who attended the November 2024 conference in solidarity with the peoples of the Sahel. Eugene, could you talk about how the Alliance of Sahel States and its three members have moved to free themselves from neoliberalism and French neocolonialism?
Well, I think, you know, and I appreciate the question. When we look at all three countries in the Alliance for Sahel States, the way we can maybe sum it up in kind of a bottom line way is the way that they are reclaiming their sovereignty, challenging neocolonialism, is to really rearrange the economic setup that previously meant that despite these countries were very, very rich in terms of mineral resources in particular, the people there were extremely poor. And this is sort of turning that pyramid on its head, where instead of the vast majority of the wealth being extracted by people who live outside the country and a small sliver of people inside the country on top, they're changing a range of different policies to make sure the wealth that comes from under the soil and from the human material of the country is being more broadly distributed amongst the people of these various Sahelian countries in the Alliance for Sahel States.
The nations of the Confederation have nationalized key resources and moved to escape from the neocolonial extractive economy trap. Could you explain the trap and talk about their steps to industrialize?
Absolutely. Now, one thing for people to understand is that in the context of most of the minerals that are under the soil, which is when we're talking about Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, we're talking about uranium, we're talking about gold, we're talking about lithium, we're talking about iron ore. I mean, we're talking about all of the things that sort of make modern society run and also make it glitter with gold when we think about the first world countries of Europe and the United States. So that is what is coming out of these countries by and large. There are other things that they also are exporting agricultural products and things like that. But by and large, the vast majority of wealth being created from these countries is mineral extraction to either feed the economy of more developed countries or to gild the lifestyle of the rich and the powerful in many of these same countries, and honestly, even many average everyday people. And the way that works is that you have the majority of the companies that have the actual technology that you need in order to extract these things from the ground tend to come from Europe, tend to come from the United States, also come from China, Turkey, other places. They tend to come from places outside of these various countries. And so on the one hand, you have, you know, foreign companies that need to make their profit. They have the technology, so they have the ability to set more of the terms. So that right there means that they're going to ask for terms that are going to tend to be less favorable, more favorable to them, and perhaps less favorable to the countries themselves. So that's the first thing that you can see changing across all of the countries in the alliance of the Sahel states, is they're changing that state of affairs in a couple different ways. One is that they're requiring more significant amounts of the wealth that is created to be returned to them in terms of higher tax revenues, higher tax percentages in terms of what the state gets on anyone who's extracting minerals. On the same token, you're also seeing in many of the cases, the governments trying to bring in joint ventures where they are getting a certain percentage of the overall value of the company. Like instead of just getting X amount of money in taxes, they also own 20% of the company or whatever it may be, 35%, you know, more than that in any given situation. And it's not the same in all three countries, but think of it like that. They're getting an equity share. So in addition to the tax money, they're also getting a percentage of the revenues. So right there, you have a significant amount of the wealth that was being extracted from the country being returned into the coffers of the nation to be spent in different ways that we can talk about through taxes and through more ownership of these varying companies. And you look at a country like Mali, which in just the past year or so has returned at least about $500 million in lost tax revenues from past years, which gives you a sense of how bad the situation was. In addition to having low rates, they were also just not paying taxes, many of these foreign companies, but it gives you a sense of the scale of these changes. They're bringing in hundreds of millions of extra dollars a year just by increasing the amount you have to pay in taxes, and also by increasing or putting more joint ventures in place where the government has a larger share and ownership of the company and thus distribution of the profits and the dividends that come with it. So that's, I think, the main way you can see the relationship changing in terms of the neoliberal trap is the primary wealth creator, which was principally drained from the country. Now more of that wealth is going back to the government and being redistributed broadly amongst the people.
What about attempts to industrialize the mining industry, developing a more complex division of labor and a wealthier society?
Yes, no, that's a great question. And I should have spoke to that before. And you can see that many of the countries are also trying to move up the value chain exactly the way you are describing. So for instance, in Mali, they've built one of the world's largest lithium mines in order to be able to not just mine it, but also start to process the mining, the initial stages of processing the lithium when it comes out of so it's a lithium refinery and mine that is coming out of the ground. You can see inside of Burkina Faso, they're starting to build gold refineries so that there's a lot of gold coming out of Burkina Faso, but none of it's refined there. So they're starting to refine that as well. So we're seeing in basic minerals an increase of connecting mining and refining in order to make sure that some of the initial stages of the manufacturing process in terms of adding value to these various products is done in the country and not fully outside of the country. But it's also happening outside of major minerals. I mean, you just saw recently in Burkina Faso, the president inaugurated a facility that'll be able to make flour from wheat and other forms of grain so that they'll be able to import less flour and make more of their own bread and other basic foods inside of Burkina Faso right there, where they also, they have a lot of tomatoes they export in Burkina Faso, but they had no plant making ketchup. So now they're making ketchup and I think tomato paste and other forms of value added. So you can see all across both the mineral and the agricultural value chain, all of the various countries inside of the Alliance of Sahel States, from oil refining to making ketchup, to refining gold, to lithium, to all these other pieces, are attempting to add more value to the things that they're being produced out of the ground, not just sending out raw materials for others to turn into commodities that they can sell for higher prices.
Right. Okay. Most of all, the Sahel states need to escape from the tyranny of the CFA franc, which traps them in French financial structures, French and European, I imagine. What do you think of the prospects for that?
Well, I think the prospects are higher than they were before the creation of the Alliance of Sahel States. I mean, it's a conversation that is very much on the lips of people there. I mean, I know there have been official conferences even held by different governments at different times where they've brought together experts to talk about it. There are people talking about it just in a civil society sense. It's certainly a direction I think those countries want to go, but to launch a new currency is obviously challenging because you have the issue of what's going to back the currency, of the currency in and of itself, of the challenges of then rearranging your economy and being prepared in the correct way when you introduce a new currency, especially one that, you know, floats instead of the CFA bank, which is pegged to the euro. So you have to do different central bank pieces. And a lot of those central banking functions are collectivized because of the CFA franc across a range of West African and Central African countries. And, you know, you also even have that. You have the CFA franc in West Africa, the CFA franc in Central Africa. So you have the combination of all these factors that to unravel yourself from that is not really a light switch. And so I think the stage and where we are in the Alliance of Sahel States is not to move aggressively on a currency reform, but to start to move deliberately on currency reform, really by starting the conversation of what the mechanics of it looks like in order to really start to lay the groundwork and to think about what could make it sustainable over time so that it's a transition that as the economies continue to develop and grow, it becomes more of a possibility. Because of course, you know, one of the biggest aspects of the CFA franc, and we're talking about the issue of you know, producing more from the goods in the ground. So let's say you want to have lithium in Mali and you want to make batteries and export them to countries around the world with EVs. Well, if you have a CFA franc, it makes it harder to devalue your currency to make your exports something that are more attractive to countries outside of there. So you have all these different challenges in terms of the development process that they are unable to really push forward to their full potential because of the CFA franc. But if they move too fast, it could also become a destabilizing factor, I think, in the overall economic growth that we're seeing. And we are seeing a lot of growth. I mean, Niger is actually one of the fastest growing countries on earth, not just in Africa. So we are seeing growth and expansion of a lot of these economies. I watched an interesting video from, I think it was Senegalese TV, where they went to a market in Burkina Faso and we're talking to people, how is it under the new government? And people are saying the markets are booming and we're selling all our goods and it's better than it's been. And the security things that are happening vis-a-vis the, you know, struggle against these various terroristic activities are making it easier for us to trade. So you can see that the policies are starting to have an impact, but ultimately they're going to have to address the CFA franc.
Western elites are, of course, concerned about Russian influence. What do you think of the Sahel state's situation in the new Cold War?
Well, you know, the Sahel states, in a way, are one of the front lines in the new Cold War, but through no fault of their own, really. The Sahel states had a critique that they developed of the security and economic cooperation with primarily Europe, in particular France, but also to some degree the United States. But at no time did they ever say that they wanted to sever all relations with any of these countries, just that they wanted to, in fact, be sovereign and be able to dictate more of the terms of what of the engagement between those countries. And that was something that especially France was unwilling to do. And so ultimately in that context, we've seen the Alliance of Sahel States pursue different security partnerships by working more with Russia vis-a-vis the struggle against these ISIS and Al-Qaeda linked groups, and also by continuing to deepen their relationships, which were already relatively strong with countries, particularly in Asia and other parts of Africa, and of course, with themselves. And I think when you look at the issue of the security, I mean, you know, France had been there for decades, and still the Sahel was one of the regions of the world that was most racked by violence and terrorism. So you can, I think, also argue, and I think people were certainly arguing this on the ground, and this is why it became a motivating factor in these military popular uprisings, that they had to switch teams, that to put it in, you know, crass terms, that ultimately the alliance with France was not delivering security, which is what it was supposed to do. And I think many people saw it as just being part of enforcing an economic relationship between France and Europe in these countries that was deeply unequal. And so they wanted to have a change, and Russia was offering a different, you know, subset of relationships. And I think the same is true in general. So I think it's important to note that when we think about what the new Cold War and how, or how the new Cold War relates to these Sahel states, it's really how these Sahel states are being victimized in the new Cold War, not how they're becoming proxies of Russia or the way it's presented in the Western media, that in fact they are being essentially demonized and punished for to make their own choices about who the most appropriate partners are to secure their own internal security, and also in terms of securing their own economic sovereignty and development in the way they think is correct.
Yesterday, there was news that Niger had kicked out a Chinese mining company, told them to leave in one day, I think, for exploiting workers and not paying taxes and all the usual sort of exploitive, extractive behaviors that the West is guilty of. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes, I have to say, first and foremost, I'm not surprised. I mean, Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, one thing that they have really stressed since these military popular uprisings is the letter of the law. No matter who you are, no matter where you're from, they've penalized companies that are from their own countries. They've penalized companies from China, companies from Europe, companies from America. I don't think they're discriminating at all. They're just saying we have certain laws as it concerns workers' rights, as it concerns mining rights, as it concerns taxes and our own development. And if anyone violates those rights, we are going to hold them accountable. And I think that unfortunately, there are companies from, every country that are, bad actors in terms of mining and other industries inside of Africa. Now, what I will say is when you look at the sort of sum total, I think there's a very different reality to it. And I think one is, you look at, let's say Chinese companies specifically, just on the private companies era, Chinese companies tend to follow the rules when the rules are enforced, where Western companies tend to leave countries as opposed to trying to follow the rules. So you look at, say, a country like Eritrea, where a lot of the mining companies are, in fact, linked to China. Obviously, they're following very strict rules in terms of their extraction. You look at, say, Orano, which is the big uranium company in Niger, that actually just has exited the country, essentially. And this is after years of basically not taking uranium out of the ground because Niger had said that they wanted to extract heavier royalties on top of it. So you see a much more coercive attitude by Western companies towards, the reality of countries in Africa trying to have more sovereignty. But as a friend of mine in Zambia says, Africa doesn't really have a China problem, it has a capitalism problem. So insofar as many countries are 100% willing to overlook bad acts because the authorities themselves are benefiting from the unequal extraction of goods, I think that there are companies from China, from America, from Europe who are going to take advantage of that. But when we see from a point of view of enforcement, the companies that are willing to keep doing business when countries have tough enforcement, Chinese companies seem to be one of the few countries that are willing to play by the rules and are able to find a place in countries like Eritrea, like Zimbabwe, like now the Sahel states. DRC is also a good example of this, where there are, pushes to have more of a letter of the law approach to make sure that companies are treating workers right and contributing to development directly. And then you add on top of that, that the Chinese government is one of the biggest providers of state support and infrastructure support and other forms of critical economic relationships, in healthcare and in education that are also facilitating the development goals of African countries in a way that Western countries are not doing in any way, shape, or form, which is why here the discourse in the West is we have to catch up with China in terms of the different, things they're bringing in from airports to ports to railroads to roads to hospitals to schools that are contributing in a way that's well beyond just the issue of companies, in and of themselves and particular policies.
Okay, all three of the Sahel states have been fighting jihadi terrorists armed with the weapons that NATO introduced into North Africa when it destroyed the Libyan state. They've expelled the French and US military who were claiming to fight the problem that they'd created. All three countries are now fighting jihadi terrorism on their own. I believe that 40% of Burkina Faso is under jihadi control. Do you think they have a better chance of winning these wars now that French and US military are gone?
I think so. I think when you look at the long engagement of the French and the US military, it didn't seem to be having much effect. I mean, the problem seemed to actually be getting worse. So it's hard to really credit them with much ability to really turn the corner or to curb the situation. They've had a number of years to do so and were unable to do so. I think when you look at what's happening now, you can see it's going up and down in different ways. I mean, I think it's still a mixed bag. Certainly they are fighting very aggressively, but I think they're also trying to fight more sustainably. I mean, you mentioned Burkina Faso, who one of their main strategies in terms of how they're addressing the security issue is to engage more Burkinabe people and to have more of a popular mobilization against these various terroristic groups as opposed to relying on outside forces. And I think they think that people trying to reclaim their own land for their own development in and of itself will make the fight more appropriate. Because when you think about the fight, that's what it really is about. I mean, you have these various jihadi groups that are really benefiting from the intense poverty that exists in these countries. I mean, I'm talking about like in 2021, like when Mali happened and this wave of military popular uprising started, all three of these countries had between like 85% and 95% of people living on less than 7 $7 a day. So you've got people who are living in extreme and intense poverty. There's a lack of development and infrastructure. So for instance, they'll maybe take over an area, one of these groups that has gold mines. They'll smuggle the gold out of one of these countries, essentially illegally, but they use the money that they're able to generate there to pay people who have almost no prospects in life or access to opportunity, say, come fight with us and we'll pay you. And you'll have all these different, you know, things that you can have that are so great. And so in many ways, the struggle against terrorism is also the struggle for development, because part of what drives it is the underdevelopment of the country. And then the ability of these groups to disrupt the transport of agricultural goods, for instance, which makes it harder to have food sovereignty. The fact that they're smuggling out critical minerals so that they're not able to actually be put into the general wealth of society and redistributed in a way that everyone can benefit from them. All of these are the ripple effects of this sort of fight. And so I think that's what we're really starting to see, and why I do think that there is more of a chance for them to turn the corner in the current iteration, because they're all looking to make these sort of mass popular mobilizations where the whole of a people are recognizing the connection between security and development, working together on a range of different fronts, both fighting and in different ways supporting the efforts more intensely there locally, in terms of, you know, mobilizing collectively to donate to collective economic projects to lift up the countryside and people in urban areas, working together like to keep medical centers clean and to help rehabilitate them through volunteer labor. All these things coming together all at once as part of a holistic security strategy that includes development, which is something that we did not see with the previous relationships with the West, I think is something that is opening up some interesting new prospects. And I think that you can see there are other partners other than France and Europe and the United States willing to work with them on strengthening various security measures.
Okay, the Sahel States Alliance declared that they're breaking down unnatural borders created when European states carved up Africa at the 1885 Berlin Conference. At the same time, other African nations are at odds or even at war over reclaiming pre-colonial borders. Like Rwanda is carrying out a devastating war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo to reestablish what it claims are pre-colonial borders. In 2018, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia created a promising alliance, but now Ethiopia seems to be on the verge of going to war with either Eritrea or Somalia to reestablish what it calls pre-colonial access to the sea. Could you talk about this whole project of breaking down colonial borders?
Yes, and this is an important issue, you know, I mean, and it became a major issue in the foundation of the Organization of African Unity in the 1960s when they decided to respect the borders, was the fear that sort of being too, I guess, cavalier about what is true, which are that these borders were drawn by colonizing powers and that many of them did not consider critically important issues from the point of view of socioeconomic realities of Africa, but that ultimately, since they had been established for some time, you know, you could have a tinderbox for wars and conflicts and power grabs. So the issue of uniting Africa, Pan-Africanism, of overcoming colonial borders has to be a voluntary shared process. It can't be one that is happening through wars and conflicts. And that's what's different with the Alliance of Sahel States, is that you have the masses of people who were supporting these individual military, popular military uprisings, I call them, that had very similar roots, that had very similar relationships between the different countries in terms of how they looked. And in terms of the economics of those countries, it's not that realistic that they're going to be able to lift themselves out of poverty alone. And so there needs to be more general Pan-African unity, not just between those three countries and others. And so you saw the people themselves sort of demand that the governments look for opportunities to find ways to work more closely together. And, you know, even having just been in Niger recently, and I know we can talk about that later, you can even see, you know, the political culture in the countries really is heavily supportive of this. So I think this is the question that has always, you know, bedeviled Africa, is how do we create a project? And I think since the 1945 Manchester Conference, really since some of the earlier Pan-African conferences, this has been something that has been widely recognized, that African countries, in order to maximize their potential, which certainly will lift its people out of poverty and offer them prosperity, it's only going to happen through more unity. But how to do that in a way that is sensitive to the realities of every region, that can be as voluntary as possible, and that doesn't devolve into, you know, sort of warlord-based power grabs, that's a difficult and a challenging question. You know, as our mutual friend Ilias Samari often says, you know, in China, they had the 100 years of humiliation. In Africa, we've had the 500 years of humiliation. But when we think about the Chinese example, that was a huge question for those 100 years, where you had all these warlords and different people sort of warring over who was going to control the state and breaking it in different ways, and they had to find their own path to unity. And I think Africa is very much on that journey. And unfortunately, we have many tragic conflicts happening right now that, you know, I hope end soon. But it's a part of that journey of figuring out how do we have more alliance of Sahel state style, popular based, very voluntary projects of Pan-African unity, and fewer and ultimately no wars and sort of forcible attempts by individuals to grab territory for the gain of the narrow elites of this or that country.
Okay. For anti-colonialists, anti-imperialists, and socialists like ourselves, the Confederation of Sahel States may be the brightest spot on the planet. Many are very emotional about the need to defend it from inevitable destabilization schemes. So what was it like to attend the conference in solidarity with the peoples of the Sahel in Niamey, Niger?
You know, it was amazing. I mean, it's hard to even describe. I mean, to be there, we were at this conference in Niamey. It was mainly Nigerians attending, but also people from Mali, Burkina Faso, and all around the continent, but mainly from the AES, you know, a couple thousand people throughout the number of days. I mean, we were fully immersed in civil society. I mean, that's the thing that you really started to see. And I think the thing that really was the biggest imprint on me is when you talk about these as sort of popular uprisings where the military was uniting with a segment of the people, you actually sort of saw what that meant. Because you started to see people who were from, you know, this organization or from that trade union or from this collective farm project or from this political party who had all come together to be a part of like these huge protests many of us had seen on social media to kick out the French, but who also had been the people in the streets, you know, supporting the governments, you know, when they called them just normal coup d'etats, people who were coming out in huge numbers to support the new leaders. And, you know, one individual who spoke from the floor, I remember he said something poignant. He said, you know, his whole life, he was, I don't know, maybe late 20s. He said, my whole life, we've been every 5 years voting, and every politician says they're going to give us roads, hospitals, and schools, and somehow there's no roads, hospitals, and schools. And he said, what we need now is not to worry about the issue of formal democracy and formal voting. To work on coming together to build roads, hospitals, and schools. And you really start to see that, you know, reality happening. I mean, you talk about Niger. I mean, this is a country that, you know, just I was reading an interesting interview with the head of electricity there, the Ministry of Electricity, where, you know, in just 2 years, they've essentially doubled the access to electricity, where they're trying it 5 years to connect 2.5 million people, or actually nearly 3 million people to electricity, hundreds of villages adding solar panels so that they can have dozens and dozens of health centers in rural areas that will not only be renovated with the money they're now getting from having more control of their own resources, but have their own power source so that they can also, you know, have more social services, be able to, you want to have factories, you got to be able to run them. And you see all these things happening and you can see the sort of power of the people, so to speak, that is really behind it. Really a part of it. I mean, just another quick example, you know, in Burkina Faso, they're really trying to put more of a focus on the quality of produce so that there's only good quality produce being found in the marketplaces. So recently they found 60 tons of expired potatoes, but instead of just throwing them in the trash, they gave them to an organization that works on composting so they can turn it into organic fertilizer so that they can then sell it at preferential rates farmers to support their goal of having 30% of all of their arable land in agroecology, sustainable agriculture by 2040. So you can see how at every different level, from protest in the streets to participation in the economy through, you know, collective and cooperative agriculture, to the building up of new industries, that wheat factory I mentioned earlier that they're making in Burkina Faso, 300 direct jobs, 10,000 seasonal jobs. So at every different level, you know, from popular mobilization to people organizing small civil society organizations, to volunteers coming together to try to keep their city clean, to engaging in all these different sort of economic development projects. There's such a thick sort of popular activity around it that so much in the West is like, oh, well, they got rid of elections. And it's sort of missing that there's this small D democracy that you can really see growing up in so many different ways in the country in a really beautiful fashion. And I think we were able to see that at the conference in a way that was powerful. And everywhere you go, the representations of the Alliance of Sahel States are everywhere. The Nigerian military, the patch they have on their arm is not Niger, it's all three countries. You know, and now they have the flag that's coming about. They're renaming streets after anti-colonial heroes, which we were able to see something. We were at the Thomas Sankara Memorial at the end of a march in solidarity with Palestine, where we had people joining us from the streets of Niamey to be a part of it. I mean, there were so many cool moments and it was interesting, but there's real change happening in these countries in big and small ways, but it's adding up significantly.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say?
You know, I think the thing I would just add is when we look at what's happening here, this is going to be something that's very threatening to the most powerful people around the world. We already saw them pressure the ECOWAS states to put in sanctions. Now, thankfully, those sanctions were defeated by and large, although the overhang from them is still there. But in this moment we're in, this is why cases like the Mahmoud Khalil case, even though it seems maybe separate because it's Palestine, are important. When you think about what are the consequences of saying that the U.S. imperialist government has the ability to just determine who can speak based on whether or not they are speaking in favor of someone declared to be an enemy. And this is one of the most sort of vital anti-colonial, anti-neocolonial, anti-imperial struggles on the planet in the Sahel. So, you know, if it starts at Palestine, where does it keep going? And I think that's something we have to really keep in mind in this current moment, how sometimes things that seem siloed off, you know, for all the green card holders who are coming from the Alliance of Sahel States, who are living here in the United States, who want to speak out in favor of their government, for all of us who may be citizens of the United States who want to support these kind of projects, we could really be in trouble if our avenues of solidarity are shut down, when this is something that is urgently needed for the Alliance of Sahel States, is for people around the world to push their own governments to give them more space to be sovereign and to experiment. So if we don't have the right to free speech, we'll have a lot more trouble building that kind of people-to-people diplomacy, and these countries have already been in the crosshairs. So we should see how a lot of what's happening with these crackdowns on the Palestine solidarity movement, the movement in solidarity with this radical upsurge in Pan-Africanism, which has been in solidarity with Palestine, could easily be in the same crosshairs just as easily, because these countries are pursuing something that is really undermining this system of wealth creation on the backs of African people.
Okay, Eugene Puryear, thanks for speaking to Pacifica.
Thanks so much for having me.
Le Sahel est en première ligne du changement climatique. La crise bouleverse la vie de millions de personnes. Elle attise les flammes du conflit. Elle déracine les familles. La violence et la faim menacent des millions de personnes. Mais les communautés se lèvent et ripostent. Nous ne serons pas vaincus. Ensemble, nous pouvons changer les choses.
That was My Sahel, a collaboration between seven artists of the Sahel. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. The Trump-Musk administration has cut all funding to the National Endowment for Democracy, which supports the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center, a group that last year received nearly $30 million from the endowment and around $40 million from USAID. In a new court filing, the Solidarity Center is pleading for the restoration of government funding. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke with Professor Kim Sipes, who has studied the AFL-CIO's international regime change operations for decades.
One of the things about this is that you have to understand, this is not the whole AFL-CIO. It's a very top, very narrow, top-level foreign policy leaders. And like I say, they've been carrying this foreign policy out for over 120 years. And to this date, they have never given an honest report to their members about this foreign policy,
Isn't it the case that they don't want to give a report? I know in my union, the CWA, remember the News Guild, they don't want to discuss it. They don't want to report on it, even though they have hundreds of people on the staff of the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center. They've never made a report what they're doing, what countries are involved in. And aren't these people who work for the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center really government agents, in the sense that their salaries are paid for by the government and they have to go through a process of hiring in which you know, the government is involved because it operates as an appendage of the U.S. government.
Yeah, that's the point made, Steve, is that the AFL claims it's part of the labor movement when in reality it's not. You're right. They are hired by the U.S. government. They are work for the U.S. government. Their funds are paid by the U.S. government. And yet the foreign policy leadership in the AFL-CIO claims them as part of the labor movement. Now, what makes this new filing so important? The Solidarity Center gets over half of its budget from the National Endowment for Democracy. So they're in over 100 countries around the world. They're claiming to be helping freedom and democracy. In reality, they're not promoting democracy as you and I know it, you know, the one person, one vote, the thing that most Americans understand, you know, if you're being affected by something, you get to vote. They're not promoting that type of democracy. The NED has been doing all this stuff. The Solidarity Center has been part of it. And now, under Trump, Trump decided to cut off all the funding to the National Endowment for Democracy. All right. Then the NED has filed a lawsuit in the Federal District Court in New York. But one of the things that's real interesting is that they took a statement from Shauna Baden-Blau, who is the executive director of the NED, and she gave a report to the court that she's never given, or she or anyone else has ever given to union members, talking about that their foreign policy has gone back to the 1890s, like I said, that it's funded by the United States, that over 50% of their budget comes from the National Endowment Democracy through the State Department, through NED. The other, by the way, is the U.S. Agency for International Development. That's a parallel institute. And that they've been working around the world. And she condemns that. We thought they were only in 60-plus countries. She concludes over 70. And in this document, she admits that, you know, she doesn't really say a whole lot as far as detail. It's very vague. She makes these vague claims. She provides no evidence for their work. But what we see is they're operating in a number of countries around the world, none of which she describes what they're doing, why they're there, who they're working with, for what trade union purposes. And that this has been more information than we've had ever from the AFL-CIO. So the importance of this, I think, is quite serious. And it's not just outside researchers. I mean, even though we're in the labor movement, we're considered outsiders. It's not just something the outsiders are talking about, but she's now confirmed this stuff. So for example, altogether, she's talking about an annual budget of approximately $78 million. That has never been explained. There's never been any detailed reporting on it. It's behind the backs of members. It's operating in our name. And she's confirmed what a lot of us who've been writing and acting against this stuff have been claiming. So it's been an important document.
And they say that they have 26 field offices, or they're going to have to close. And she says that they are going to have to declare bankruptcy if they don't get this money.
Well, exactly. And it brings the point that their operations are almost totally funded by the U.S. government. It's not supported by the labor movement. This is not work that has been approved by the labor movement through any of our processes. It's never been reported. It's never been detailed. And what we're finding out is that it's almost all coming from the U.S. government. And now that Trump's cut it off, this whole project, which they're so very proud of, and like I say, it's gone on for over 120 years, is about to be shut down.
And isn't this a part and parcel of corporate unionism, business unionism? I mean, the formation of the AFL-CIO, in fact, was the formation of a pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist trade union federation with the witch hunts against leftists and communists in the United States, and the establishment of a union federation, which said they wanted to be in partnership with the bosses, with the capitalists in this country, and to act as an arm of U.S. imperialism around the world. Wasn't that the foundation of the AFL-CIO?
Largely. I mean, it's a little more complex than that, and I won't go into that here. I've done it in a lot of my writings. But yes, it's been a very pro-capitalist operation. Some of us think that the U.S. is the center of a U.S. empire, and that the top leaders in the labor movement believe that the U.S. should run the world. The U.S. has dominated the world since 1945. Especially after the Soviet Union fell, that domination became more transparent. But the U.S. has been not acting as a regular country, but they have an empire, and that's what I think you see Trump is trying to do, is preserve that empire. But the top leaders of AFL-CIO, without any debate, any discussion, anything like that, have supported that unequivocally. And as we know, they've helped work, even though they're supposed to be helping workers, we know they've overthrown democratically elected governments. We know they've supported a number of dictatorships around the world. We know there are they've supported reactionary labor movements against progressive labor movements. All this has been documented between my book and Shirky's book. You get a pretty clear view of that.
Well, also, they're supporting the genocide in Gaza. The AFL-CIO leadership, most of them say that they're Zionist. They support Zionism, and they support military aid, more bombs and weapons to Israel to commit genocide. I mean, this internationalism of the AFL-CIO in relationship to both Israel and the genocide going on, but also defending being an appendage of the U.S. government in its international operations, doesn't that really show that they're in reality they're not an independent trade union movement. They're an appendage of U.S. government and U.S. imperialism.
Well, I think it's a little more complex than that, in that the labor movement, it's these top-level leaders supposedly acting for all of us, but in reality,
we're talking about
themselves.
Liz Shuler, who was on the board of directors of the National Endowment for Democracy.
She was, and now she's president of the AFL-CIO. Fred Redmond was also on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy. Other people folks might know, or folks like Henry Kissinger was on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy. Yes, this whole operation is tied in together very much with the highest levels of the U.S. Well, I would call it the empire. Others would call it the highest U.S. foreign policy apparatus.
They're what does Trump want to do? Because he says now, and Musk, that basically, first of all, he said that these people were opposed to Trump, that the National Endowment for Democracy were criticizing Trump and his agents. But you think that they're getting rid of the soft hand and saying, let's just invade, let's just take over using the military. We don't need any of these so-called reform programs or role of the AFL-CIO internationally, like in the Philippines or Thailand. They're big in Thailand. They were big in Ukraine. I mean, the AFL-CIO was in favor of privatizing Ukraine. They supported union officials in Ukraine who were for the right wing or the European oligarchs or American oligarchs to take over Ukraine instead of the Russian oligarchs. So it seems that in relationship to privatization, which the AFL-CIO says they're against, they're actually supporting privatization around the world through the Solidarity Center.
Absolutely. Absolutely. By the way, one of the things about the Ukraine that's real interesting, back in 2014, right after the so-called Maidan Revolution, there was a fire in the Trade Union Congress house. I forget the exact name.
In Odessa, you're talking about.
Yeah, in Odessa. It was put on fire. And then there were something like 50 people that were burned to death there. I have never seen, normally when something like that happens, the AFL-CIO will put out a solidarity statement or something like this. I've never been able to find any response into the fact that the Trade Union Center house was burned down and these people were trapped in there and burned to death. So there's a lot of involvement in Ukraine that still hasn't come out, but they definitely were involved there. But they've been involved in all kinds of places: Armenia, Kazakhstan, Thailand, like you say, the Philippines. You know, we've
South
got
Africa
a few
in South Africa. They were involved in supporting the apartheid regime. They actually financed Chief Buthelezi.
Yes.
Gave him $1 million, over $1 million. And he was attacking and murdering trade unions in South Africa, organizing in COSATO. And he was given an award, Labor Man of the Year, the Meanie Award, by the AFL-CIO, at the same time that he was attacking trade unions in South Africa and supported the apartheid regime. He supported Bantustan states.
Yeah. And this is what's very interesting. In this very document that Bader Blau just filed in support of the NED, she claims that the AFL-CIO was helping to end apartheid. Well, it was only after American trade unions revolted from the bottom that they shifted their position. But you're absolutely right. The stuff on Buthelezi in particular is particularly obnoxious. And we've got this.
And Chile, there was a commemoration of the coup in Chile, which the United States AFL-CIO was involved in overthrowing the Allende government and supporting Pinochet, privatization of the Chilean economy. It seems like the policy of U.S. imperialism They were an appendage too, and even in Mexico, the AFL-CIO was involved in attacking Ford workers in Mexico. They organized goons to attack a militant union group at the Ford Assembly plant in Mexico City. One worker was killed. They've never been held accountable for that role in the Mexican working class. It seems they have a pretty sordid, bloody history in Brazil and Argentina, where there are military coups and thousands of trade unions were killed, murdered, kidnapped at Ford, other companies, Mercedes. I mean, the AFL-CIO has never been held accountable for this. I mean, in fact, most, as you say, AFL-CIO members have no knowledge of the role of the AFL-CIO. Why is that? I mean, it seems like it's has been a non-issue in the AFL-CIO.
Well, unfortunately, I think you're right. I mean, I think this gets to the fact that the type of democracy the NED is pushing around the world. So this is a, like I say, it's not the type most Americans think of. It's a constrained democracy. Leaders get to decide the width of the discussion or who can run for office or whatever. And then they let the peons vote or whatever within that constraint.
That was Professor Kim Sipes, who reports on the likely bankruptcy of the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center, which is nearly completely funded by NED and other government agencies. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. On April 5th, protesters rallied against President Donald Trump and Elon Musk's draconian federal budget cuts. The nationwide hands-off protests demanded that the administration keep its hands off Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, public lands, consumer protection, and more. At a small protest on the sidelines of the Washington, D.C. rally, Code Pink's Jody Evans criticized the inclusion of hands-off NATO and the exclusion of hands-off Palestine.
No to NATO! Yes to peace! So here we are at the hands-off march at the foot of the Washington Monument. This is a march that says hands off. And we're saying hands off Palestine. We're here with this sculpture to show what is happening. The people don't seem to notice because it is nowhere in the conversation here. But what's amazing is that we've already given away a whole roll of stickers that says feminists stand with Palestine. So in their hearts it's there, but in the messaging it's not. We're here to raise up the hearts, the empathy for those people, those children, those mothers, those caregivers, those ambulance drivers, those media workers, those press people that have been murdered by the IOF, by Israel, with our tax dollars. We are here to say hands off Palestine. And while we're at it, no to NATO. NATO is a violent force that has been creating death and destruction for decades. Not hands off it. No to NATO. Yes to peace.
That was Code Pink's Jody Evans on the sidelines of the Hands Off rally in Washington, D.C. The Trump administration is carrying out a sweeping anti-labor offensive against federal employees. Activists are calling the federal government's rejection of the Transportation Security Agency's union and the American Federation of Government Employees contracts a PATCO moment in union busting. The American Federation of Government Employees is a union that represents workers from New York, New Jersey, and the rest of the East Coast. Its vice president, David Gonzalez, spoke with New York Teamsters Local 808 president Chris Silvera about why this assault on federal workers is an attack on the entire labor movement.
The federal government hasn't really grown since the 1970s. You know, back when Bill Clinton did what Trump and Elon Musk is trying to do here, but they did it in a different way.
Right.
But the way Trump and Elon Musk is trying to dismantle the government, this is with no regard or no preemptive planning into looking into the government and the functions of government and what is needed for the government to work. And this is the difference of what is going on now.
Terrible people are inspecting our food when they go to the supermarket. We're exposing our families to something that could be in our food.
Exactly.
If we don't have enough TSA people, we're exposing the airlines to be unsafe.
Exactly.
If we don't have enough people processing our Social Security payments for our elders, that means grandpa and granddad may not be able to keep their license. And
so there's a broad ways that the federal workforce, and I can go on and on with these agencies, and there's a lot of misinformation. When they talked about USAID buying condoms and stuff, that was misinformation. That was not true. And Elon Musk even came back and said something later on to the fact that it was misinformation, but he said there is going to be misinformation. So this is the difference between the Trump administration. This is not normal politics. The Trump administration wants to divide us, especially the working people. They want working people to be divided so we won't be on one accord and we can't unite and with our power and get back our government and make these politicians respect the working force.
Do you see this as Pat Code 2.0? This is Pat Code now actually on steroids. So that what Reagan did to the air traffic controllers is now being heaped on the entire system, federal system?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because he's trying to destroy unions. He's going to start with us. We're low-hanging fruit because we're federal workers, and he has control of the federal workforce. So he's going to start with us, and then he'll come for you. And this is the problem. This is why we need to unite as one in labor. And this affects us because there's a lot of us in the federal workforce. Like you said, this is PATCO 2.0 on steroids.
You know, over the years, people have given a perception of this federal worker.
It's a federal worker at the VA that's taking care of our veterans and our aging veterans. So the federal workforce is important, and they make America's gradual liberty. It's a federal worker there that's keeping the grounds and giving you tours and things of that nature and making sure you have a good experience while you're in that national park.
What would you want them to know? What would you want the rank and file worker to know, to understand in this moment in time? What would you want them to understand? You
know, we're low-hanging fruit for Donald Trump and his cronies right now and Elon Musk. And so, you know, once they're finished with us, they're coming for the rest of labor. And, you know, Donald Trump is never, for those of us who lives in New York, New Jersey, And in the Northeast, we knew Donald Trump. We knew what he did to Atlantic City and how he bankrupted Atlantic City and how he didn't pay contractors and things of that nature that did work for him. And he made them go to court and wait them out because his pockets were deep and their pockets were small. So they didn't have the money to keep up with him in a court of law. So we just need to stick together as one and fight for our cause, for our work, for our working family, for our work, the working man and woman.
Just, you know, if you could sketch out
what happens is that Donald Trump and his kind gets their wish because now they can privatize out all of these jobs to his friends, to his billionaire friends, and they can make money off the federal government. It's no secret that Elon Musk, most of his contracts come from the Department of Defense, which belong to AFGE as well, the civilian workforce. And Elon Musk gets a lot of his contracts from the Department of Defense for his satellites and his space company that he has and things of that nature. So Elon Musk, now he's having say on what the federal government does and don't do in the federal workforce.
That was American Federation of Government Employees Vice President David Gonzalez in conversation with New York Teamsters Local 808 President Chris Silvera, discussing the Trump administration's sweeping anti-labor offensive against federal employees. The segment aired on the International Brotherhood of Teamsters show hosted by Richard Hooker, Secretary Treasurer of Philadelphia Teamsters Local 623. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Seltzer and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.